On this super crazy, super awesome, super fucking sweet episode of Drive with Woody Fit, I talk about this powerlifter who saved a guy who was pinned under a Jeep, how your body weight has no correlation to your body composition, how a buddy of mine texted me about buying a mass gainer and why he shouldn't have, and I kind of slapped him on the back of the head for this after reading this. BPC 157, what the fuck is that? Listen in to find out. Sumo deadlifts versus conventional deadlifts. This is to end all arguments. And then I answer some questions. Mark asks, my work is doing a Biggest Loser challenge for 2 months. What's the best way for me to lose fat and lose some weight without losing all the muscle that I've built? And Derek asks, what's the best way to get rid of belly fat besides killing yourself with 1,000 crunches? And before we get into this episode, I'd like to ask you if you could leave us a rating and review in your podcast player of choice. That way we can continue to grow the show. And if you like the show, if you really like the show, share it with a friend, family member, or foe so that we can get the word out about Drive with Woody Fit. And check out the free programs and guides that we have over at executivefitllc.com/guides. Now, without further ado, let's get into this episode of Drive with Woody Fit.
In a world full of waste trainers, fad diets, and bro science, three friends come together to drive against the myths with facts, studies, and experiences. Welcome to Drive with Woody Fit, with your hosts, Nate Woods, Megan Woods, and Michael Stewart.
So at the time I'm recording this, I'm currently, 2 days out? It's Wednesday. It's Wednesday night, and my next meet is this upcoming Saturday. So I'm like 2 weeks out from my next powerlifting meet with RPS, Revolution Powerlifting Syndicate, and I'm super excited. But this meet, this prep in particular, has been a little bit different because in terms of getting down to the 148 weight class. Now, my body is pretty much, you know, if I'm not force-feeding myself food, has found homeostasis right around, 150 to 154, right? And now, so during this meat prep, I've been force-feeding myself food to really try to increase the calorie intake, to make sure I'm not in a deficit, and to try to build as much strength as I can. Now, of course, what came along with that is some weight gain, and I think the highest that I was going into this was about 159, and that was, I didn't start tracking my weight until after I had started, it's time to think about losing weight, it's time to think about getting the body weight down to be where I need to be, 148 or below. And so 2 weeks out, I was 159. And so going into it, I'm like, fuck, this is kind of a big jump. I got to lose 11 pounds at least. At the minimum, I have to lose 11 pounds. And so I was kind of a little bit worried about getting it. But I have, and the way that I've tracked this is I have a whiteboard calendar in my kitchen. And each day that I weigh myself, I'll write the weight on the calendar so I can kind of see as time goes on how I'm doing. And so that first week is like the biggest change, because it's going from, okay, I need to start tracking this. Let's pull back the reins on some food a little bit. Let's watch how much water I'm drinking. You know, I don't necessarily want to overhydrate myself. The goal was, not really anymore because we're so close, but the goal was to just hydrate enough and not overdo it and not just chug water all day. And now, being 2 days out, we're at the point where I'm very limited on how much food I'm eating. You know, I'm not stuffing my face. I'm still eating 4 meals a day, I think. Yeah, today was 4 meals. Tomorrow will be 4 meals, and then Friday will be as many meals as I can fit in after weigh-ins. But One thing that I want to talk about is the fact that the methods that I'm doing to cause myself to lose weight are not the same methods I would use, or nor would I recommend if somebody just wanted to lose weight, because I need to lose weight for a particular time, for a particular day. And after that time of day, Friday at 11, after that time, I can weigh however much I want when I go step on stage, as long as at weigh-ins, I'm not, you know, I'm where I need to be. So the thing with that is, like, some of my friends and coworkers have seen the things that I'm doing. They're like, why are you doing that to lose weight? Why would you go about it that way? Why aren't you just dieting down, you know, eating low calorie, watching how much food you're putting into your body? And my thought process behind this is, and I'm not claiming to have invented this by all means, this is just how I'm approaching this with my knowledge of the body and how it works. My kind of process is, the food that I'm going to put in my body, you know, it's already whole natural food, right? I'm not eating processed food. I'm not eating junk food. It's already whole natural food. So in terms of how much of it am I eating, it doesn't matter to me as long as it doesn't weigh a lot. Because if you think about it this way, if you eat 1 pound of food, immediately afterwards, you will weigh 1 pound heavier. If you weighed out the food, it was exactly a pound, and that's how much you ate. Now, of course, we have this law of thermogenetics, or thermogenesis. Yeah, I think it's thermogenesis. It's not thermogenetics. Your genetics are not being burned. So we have this law of thermogenesis, and which is where your body converts the food into fuel, and then it, you know, so there's not like a full carryover. If you eat 5 pounds of food in a day, you're not going to weigh 5 pounds heavier, because your body is burning that fuel. Now, if it gets converted into fat and stored, then okay, I don't know if there's even a scientific way to figure out a weight transfer in terms of how much it weighed going in and how much it weighs being stored. But my point with this is to pay attention. I'm paying attention to the volume of food that I'm eating, you know, and I guess you could say I don't want really anything to get stored as fat, but, you know, this morning I stepped on the scale at 148.8, so in about 2 weeks I've come down off of 159, and so now at this point I need to lose 0.8 tenths of a pound come Friday at 11, which my method to make damn sure that I'm 148 or below, is to slightly dehydrate myself and kind of evacuate the bowel. And I know that sounds fucking nasty, and it kind of is, but the way that I'm going to go about that is, you know, I love my coffee, right? And, you know, at this point, I drink coffee every day, and then the first 7 days of every month is caffeine-free, you know, no stimulants whatsoever for the first 7 days of the month, but I still drink coffee in the morning. It's just decaf coffee. Roast me for that if you want to. I don't give a fuck. I'll drink decaf coffee just because I like the taste of coffee. So, you know, to me, when it comes time to weigh in, because we're getting closer, I've slowly started to cut down the amount of coffee that I'm consuming, but I have not cut down the amount of caffeine that I'm consuming. Now, what do I mean by that? I use a French press to do this. So, you know, 2 weeks ago I was doing a full French press. Now this morning I did half a French press. Tomorrow I'll do probably a quarter or a third of the French press, and I'll only consume that amount of liquid, but I'm still using the same amount of coffee to make that coffee. Now, of course, yeah, it gets strong as fuck when you start to take away some water, but that's less water than I'm putting in my body, right? Still getting the same amount of caffeine. So because caffeine is a diuretic and it will dehydrate you and it will cause you to feel like you have to shit, and it will make you have to shit, that way I can kind of, if you think about it this way, evacuate the bowels coming into this by dosing up, kind of, I guess we could say, dosing up on caffeine. And I'm not really going above and beyond, except for Friday morning will be no coffee whatsoever, decaf or regular, no coffee, but I'm going to sip on like a 5-hour energy so that I can get, you know, so that I can have my caffeine in the morning and still get that benefit of a little bit of dehydration, a little bit of, you know, getting the digestive system going and kind of excreting things. Wow, that sounds really fucking nasty. But yeah, so you know, I'm using caffeine right now as a tool to help slightly dehydrate myself. I'm watching how much water I'm consuming throughout the day. I'm not eating foods that, you know, I've been very strict with sticking to my regimen, sticking to the diet, and not cheating and not it's one donut, whatever. Like not cheating. Very, very religious at this point. And then you know, after weigh-ins, you know, it'll pretty much be a fast, a whole morning fast up until weigh-ins, to try to just cut as much water weight as I can and then replenish the body immediately afterwards. Salty foods. Oh, that's the other thing I'm doing. No sodium, very little sodium. We had tacos tonight for dinner. So instead of the seasoning packet, I just said, give me my beef raw because I like raw beef. Take that for what it's worth. Now that we've got that out of the way, because I felt like I had to say that, I felt like I needed to, I didn't really feel like I needed to justify my actions, but I feel like it's a good thing to go over is the fact that, like, you know, getting ready for a particular day is going to be different than getting ready for if you're just losing weight. And just losing weight, you know, because there's no day, you're not stopping at a certain day, you're not trying to be at a certain weight by a certain day, then it doesn't really, really matter, you know, how you progress, as long as you're tracking your progress and you're losing the weight. So that whole method is going to look different because it's really just going to be a lot of dieting down. You know, you can still hydrate, you can still drink, you know, a certain amount of water, but if that were the case, I would be focusing on drinking the same amount of water every single day, not slowly cutting down on my water intake like I have been. And it would just be, you know, keep everything as consistent as I can and then diet, you know, slowly cut calories, exercise, and all that jazz. But I recently read an article, saw this, it wasn't really an article, it was like a news post about this power lifter who saved this guy who was trapped under a Jeep. And then I followed the dude on Instagram. Some other Instagram page tagged him and in reference to the story, so I followed him. This dude is a beast, and he's just a big fat powerlifter dude, and I guess he came up to this scene where this Jeep was flipped over, and this dude was trapped inside, and he came over, and, like, just, in his words, like, I just did what I knew I could do, and did what I was good at, which is lifting things. So he just started pushing this Jeep, and just didn't stop pushing until he heard one of the other guys say, okay, we can get him. That's good, we can get him. And they pulled him out. And I just think that that just goes to show, you know, how important being physically strong is. And, you know, not to go and say that, like, everybody's going to be able to, you know, move a Jeep in a time of trouble when they need to. But, you know, having physical strength, having the ability to generate power and to generate force is important in daily life, because you never know what might happen. And, you know, you may not have to move a Jeep, but you may have to move a tree branch or something. I don't know. God forbid a tree branch falls on one of your children and you have to lift it off. Like, fuck, get it, you know. It's important to be strong. Moral of the story, it's fucking important to lift weights and be fucking strong. All right, so I've been having conversations with some clients about body weight, and a lot of times when some clients come to me, they're already motivated about losing weight. They think they're on the right track. Some of them are like, I just need help with the training. I just need you to train me, to coach me, show me what to do in the gym, and I'm already good on the diet. And a lot of times, almost every time, I tell everybody, I want to see your diet. I want to see what you're eating. I want to know what you're doing, because chances are you're not doing the right thing. And that's no fault of theirs. That's, you know, it's part of it's just a lot of it is just lack of knowledge, and that's okay. And that's why personal trainers and dietitians and nutritionists, that's why they all exist. So, you know, we'll start working with things and we'll change some things up in their diet, and they're doing great and they're consistent. And a lot of times the scale doesn't change right in the beginning. And a lot of times, even when you find homeostasis, I have a gentleman who's, we've pretty much found homeostasis with his diet, and there's still some things we're working on. But, you know, when you are very consistent with things and, you know, maybe the scale's not changing, you know, it can be demotivating, which is why it's important to track your progress in other ways. It's important to track your progress in body fat percentage. You know, not even BMI. BMI and body weight are only good to track when you are, you know, obese or morbidly obese or severely overweight. You know, the only reason I am being a 150-pound guy tracking my body weight is because I have to be a certain weight to compete in a certain weight class. Other than that, I might step on the scale once a month just to see where I am, you know. But what I do every day is essentially a body fat test. You know, standing naked in front of the mirror, or stand in front of the mirror with my shirt off and see what it looks like. You know, although that's the most basic body fat test there is, but you stand in front of the mirror and you look and see, how lean am I? You know, how much definition do I have? And keep in mind what your diet's been like, what you've been doing, how much water you've been drinking. And so I think it's important to remember and to know that body weight has absolutely no correlation to your body composition, right? So what you are made of, what, like, in ratio to lean body mass and body fat, body weight has no correlation to that, because you can take the same person, 6 foot tall, 6 foot zero, 250 pounds, and 33 BMI, and one of them is going to be shredded as fuck with a lot of lean body mass and a lot of muscle, and the other one is going to be overweight with a huge gut, you know, just a ton of body fat, but all of those three numbers will be the same: body weight, or height, body weight, and BMI. And that's why body weight and BMI are not good measurements once you've gotten down to a certain point, because it has no correlation. Take this for example. One of my clients checks in with a nutritionist once a month. So he sees me, and he also works with a nutritionist. Now this nutritionist, when he checks in, he does body weight and body fat percentage testing. A month ago, he had his body weight and body fat percentage checked, and then just recently, 1 month later, body fat, body weight checked. And the body weight, his body weight went up 1 pound, but his body fat percentage went down 2 pounds. And I'm trying to explain to him that this is a massively, massively good thing. And as a trainer, and understanding the processes that happen in the body and what this means, what this actually means that's actually happening in the body, is amazing. It's exactly what you want to look for, and it means you're doing all of the right things. Yes, you may have gained 1 pound, but your body fat percentage went down 2%, which leads me to believe that you built muscle, right? That you now have more muscle than you did 1 month ago. Even if you're, you know, you didn't gain any more fat cells down at the cellular level, if you didn't lose or gain any more fat cells, what that means is you built muscle, right? So, if you are the type of person who's obsessed with body weight, because a lot of people are, you know, you need, and I mean this as nice as I can mean it, but you need to stop that shit, because once you get to a certain point, you know, once you've lost some weight and maybe you've plateaued, or you're just kind of hovering, and, you know, your body's found homeostasis at a certain body weight, you need to find other methods of tracking your progress, whether it be performance or body fat percentage, but not body weight. And I'm not saying it's not a good idea to step on the scale. I'm not saying never step on the scale. All I'm saying is that at a certain point, tracking it no longer becomes valid, because you've pretty much got to the point where you're starting to build muscle, and you need to, in essence, what your goal is, what's happening then is you're recompositioning. You're doing a recomp of what your body composition is. You know, and you don't necessarily have to go anywhere body weight wise. So it's important to remember that. And, you know, it's also important to remember my feeling on mass gainers. And you know, this is like a really quick fucking transition, but this is how we're doing it. So hold on, because this is not going to be a slow episode. So a buddy of mine texted me just tonight, and he was like, man, I really shouldn't have bought that mass gainer, because I've only had like two servings out of it, and it's just been sitting. And I'm like, yeah, well, part of that's your consistency, and the other part of it is the fact that they fucking suck. And I'm sure that there are good mass gainers out there on the market that are not full of fillers, but for the most part, unless you want to spend a pretty penny on simply a mass gainer that's going to be more expensive per meal than real food is, you know, unless you want to spend that amount of money, then they're not worth it. So, and I've explained that I've even, when he was considering buying the mass gainer, I gave him my spiel on just make a shake with whole food and you'll get more out of it. You'll get more nutritional value out of it than you will from a powder, right? So like, think about it this way, right? When you eat whole foods, when you eat chicken breast, when you eat, you know, broccoli and cauliflower and bread and oatmeal and you eat whole foods, there's nutrients in those foods, okay? And what we've done with these supplements, with all supplements pretty much, but we'll just talk about mass gainers. What we've done with these mass gainers is we've taken those nutrients, extracted them, and put them in powder form with some flavoring so they taste good, okay? So we've taken what nature gives us, right? We've taken what you can find naturally out in nature. We've extracted the things that we want out of it. So we've isolated the things that we want out of it. We've added some fillers and some coloring and some flavoring to make it taste good. And then we're going to put that in our body. Right? That's what's happening when we use when we use protein shakes and mass gainers and all these different supplements. That's where I don't want to go and say, oh, all supplements are bad, because they're not. You know, a lot of supplements will do a lot of good. I'm currently taking like high dose essential amino acids right now, the whole spectrum of essential amino acids, and it's really helping with fixing my shoulder issue. So I'm totally not against supplements. That's not the case here. But what I'm saying is, when it comes to nutrition, because that's nutrition, that's not supplementation to me. When you're getting a mass gainer, you are supplementing your nutrition, right? Like you are instead of a meal, I'm going to do this. Whereas if you have the means to do a meal, or if you have the means to make a homemade shake, you should do that first. Because then you're taking what nature gave us, what grows and what's natural, and you are blending it up into a liquid and drinking it the same way you would a mass gainer. So there's no difference there in terms of texture, but there is a massive difference in the quality of the nutrients, because you're getting these nutrients from a natural source, from a whole natural source that occurs naturally in nature and consuming it, versus getting these nutrients from something that's been extracted and then other chemicals and flavorings have been added for whatever reason, for shelf life reasons or for taste or color or visual or texture reasons, and consuming that. So if you need a mass gainer, and if you feel like you need a mass gainer, it would be massively, it would behoove you to consider making your own. And it's so easy to do it, so easy to make a shake with 1,000 calories in it. You just have to pick the right things. So take this for example. Half a cup of walnuts, half a cup of chopped walnuts is 200 calories. Or no, half a cup of walnuts is 800, because quarter cup is 200. So half a cup of chopped walnuts is 400 calories. There's 400 calories. Like, a lot of people don't even eat 400 calorie meals, right? So there, and that's just one ingredient. So you get a bunch of other stuff bananas, you know, maybe some greens so that you can get your greens. So throw some spinach in there. Don't worry, it's not going to taste like shit. You get some almond milk. Maybe then you throw in a good quality protein shake, protein powder, a high quality lean protein powder that's just whey protein or a plant-based protein or something. You throw that in there and you invest your money in a good quality protein to do that. Or, I mean, fuck, even peanut butter, you know, as a mass gainer, peanut butter is fucking awesome. So there's so many ways that you can increase the total calories of this shake and bump the protein content up. And even that, that was only a half a cup of walnuts. Just do a whole fucking cup of walnuts and you got 800 calories there. Blend that shit up with some almond milk. And, like, I think that's, like, probably close to, like, 30 grams of protein in that shake. So, you know, it is so easy to get the same, if not more, amount of calories and proteins and carbs and everything from whole foods in a blender. You know, it's easier, if not, you can get more, the same or more. I'm fucking losing my mind. You could get the same or more amount of calories by doing it with whole foods than you could with a mass gainer shake. So, that being said, start making your fucking shakes. Invest in a blender, invest in some fucking whole food, and get rid of the fucking mass gainers, because, quite frankly, food is going to carry you so much further than using mass gainers, using, and just relying on supplements. Supplements should be there to supplement the diet, not fucking replace shit. And I mentioned how these amino acids have been helping my shoulder. And I came down to two things I was going to reintroduce. One I was going to reintroduce and one I was going to start to help with my bicep tendonitis issue in my shoulder. So the first was the essential amino acids. And I chose to go with them because they're a little bit more natural than what I'm about to talk about. And what I'm about to talk about is a peptide called BPC-157. Now, BPC-157, like I said, is a peptide, which a peptide is a chain of amino acids. Now, I'm not a scientist, so I'm not going to go into the technical terms of it, and I didn't even write those down because it would do no good to you. Just know that a peptide is a chain of amino acids. Now, BPC stands for Body Protective Compound, and I don't know who coined that term. I don't know who gave it. Body Protective Compound. I don't know who came up with that, but apparently that's what it stands for. Now, your gut will produce it naturally as a way to protect the gut from leaky gut syndrome, from things permeating the gut wall that shouldn't be permeating the gut wall. So it has a lot of protective qualities to it. And it can also, when it's extracted, it can also be used to repair strained tendons, muscles, intestines, bones, teeth, and more stuff. Now, one of the other fitness people that I follow, his name's Ben Greenfield. He has an amazing podcast. His podcast is actually the first podcast that I started listening to. It was the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show, or Fitness Podcast, whatever he calls it. And absolutely love it. Some of the shit that he talks about is a little out there, a little high-end in terms of scientific-y. He's a really fucking smart dude, but he does have some really good stuff for the average Joe. So and some of the stuff is, like, way over my head. I'm like, I can't even focus on this. But anyway, he injected 250 micrograms of BPC-157 into his elbow for 2 weeks. Now, he did this because he had tennis elbow, and he wanted to see if it would help heal his tennis elbow. Now, he did it for 2 weeks, and it cleared up his tennis elbow. He had no issues with his tennis elbow after that. Now, it can be injected, or it can be taken orally, but if you choose to inject it, it comes unconstituted, so you have to reconstitute it when you go to inject it, which means basically taking it from a powder form to a liquid form, and then you can inject it. Now, the thing with BPC-157 is the fact that Big Pharma cannot get their hands on it to market it and sell it because it's found naturally in the body. It's made naturally in the body, so they can't, like, patent it and then sell it. So it's kind of this gray market it's kind of this gray market supplement, we could call it, okay? And it's all of the reading that I've been doing into it has been, they've been, you know, it's been said like, oh, this thing is revolutionary. It, you know, this BPC-157, you know, it'll fix your tendonitis, it'll fix your torn muscles, yada yada yada, help your bones, your teeth, your gut. And every time that I see something that like is touting this thing as revolutionary or like a miracle thing, and there's a reason behind why big pharma can't get to it, it's like, okay, you know, is it, this shit's gotta be a fucking hoax. This shit's gotta be fucking marketing. But then I stumbled upon Ben Greenfield's article about it, and I was like, oh, okay, you know, because he's not going to endorse something that is a fad or that doesn't work, right? He regularly calls himself a guinea pig. So this shit might work. So I had boiled it down to how I'm going to help my shoulder. What can I take to help my shoulder? And here's the thing to remember, though, is I'm already doing all of the things I need to do to help my shoulder. And the day-to-day pain is pretty much non-existent. It's only painful when I push myself. So if I try to overhead press, if I try to incline bench press, that's when the pain happens. So that being said, I'm at the point now where it's like, okay, I'm already consistent with all the stretches, all the rotator cuff strengthening, everything else that I'm doing to fix the shoulder. Now, what can I take to help that? So I boiled it down to the essential amino acids, or BPC-157. And I decided to start with the essential amino acids, not because they were cheaper. Well, actually, they were cheaper for 1 month's dose, but I'll be taking them for longer than a month. It's going to be a regular thing. But I chose the amino acids because they're a nutrient, not a peptide. So we'll see how this goes. But, you know, I'm having a good feeling about it. Already it's been like 3 days that I've been taking this high dose essential amino acids. I think it's like 5,000 milligrams of this complex that I'm taking. So, you know, we'll see. In a couple days, I'll try to do some overhead press and some incline bench, and we'll see how it goes. But anyway, that's, you know, another side note, big thing to remember is don't look at what can I take to help me. First, exhaust all of the what can I do's, because doing 90% of the time is more important than what am I taking, right? What are you doing is much more important than what am I taking. So it's very important to remember that it's not always about what you're taking. 90% of the time, it's about what you're doing. And if you're not consistent with doing certain things, with training, if you're not consistent with lifting, you're not following a good program, you're not consistent with your diet, it doesn't matter what you take. None of that shit that you could possibly take is going to help you unless the consistency is there and you're doing everything consistent. So keep that in mind. But, you know, on a good note, you know, my shoulder issue hasn't really affected my deadlifts, and which is a nice thing because that's what I want to focus on. So, you know, I don't know, maybe the deadlifts could be the root cause, because if it's bicep tendonitis, I'm of course using my biceps when I deadlift. And so, you know, I could be chronically aggravating the issue just by deadlifting so much. So, after this meet, I might take a break from deadlifting as frequently and see what I can do to the shoulder immediately after that. But, you know, in terms of deadlifting, some of the things that have come up recently in this life has been sumo versus conventional deadlifts. And I wanted to touch on this a little bit because I think it's important to even just say right off the bat, I think they're two different exercises. I've spent time training both of them. I've spent time doing sumo deadlifts, and I currently do conventional deadlifts, and they are two different exercises. So, you know, conventional requires 5 to 10% greater lean. And when I say greater lean, I mean more hinging at the hip, right? So you're bent over at the hip more in a conventional deadlift than you are in a sumo deadlift. Now, this will put more tension on the back, especially your erectors, your spinal erectors, your erector spinae. the muscles that runs down, you know, there's tons of muscles that are there, but the muscles that run down your spinal cord, those are your erector spinae are there. And so this, your conventional position puts more strain on them versus your sumo position. And real quick, if you don't know what a sumo deadlift is, you don't know what a conventional deadlift is, a sumo deadlift is where you have a very wide stance, like almost to the point where one toe may almost be touching the plate on either side. And a conventional deadlift is where you have like a shoulder width or narrower deadlift stance. But sumo will actually put more demand on your quads. And this creates less ankle dorsiflexion in the starting position. So dorsiflexion is when, if you were to lift your toes up, right? Plantar flexion is when you push your toes down. Imagine doing a calf raise, that's plantar flexion. So dorsiflexion is the opposite direction. So in a sumo position, there's less dorsiflexion, which can be good, which means if you have ankle mobility issues, deadlifting sumo may be a little bit easier for you just to get down to that position. But with conventional, there is less demand on your quads. And quad strength usually doesn't limit your conventional deadlift, whereas sometimes with your sumo deadlift, quad strength can limit how much you can sumo deadlift. Now, if you think about the sumo deadlift, it's almost like a squat. It is very similar to a squat. The biggest difference is where the bar is in space, okay? So in a normal squat, the bar is on your back. In a sumo deadlift, the bar is on the floor and you're moving it upwards. So, but if you look at the hip hinging and the angle of the humerus in the hip joint and the angle of the knee in a sumo deadlift, it looks very similar to a squat. So that's a good way to think about why a sumo deadlift puts more stress on the quads. Now, research has shown that the hip extension demands are the same for conventional and sumo. So basically, the further that your hips are from the bar, the harder it is for your hip extensors to work, right? So conventional requires 25 to 40% more mechanical work than sumo. And this is because of the further distance that the bar needs to travel in a conventional deadlift. Now, this is just proven, right? If you stand very wide, you're going to be shorter than if you stand with your feet at shoulder width, hands down. What that basically means is that the bar has to travel further in a conventional deadlift, which means that there's more mechanical movement and work that has to happen. Now, if you have weak spinal erectors, if you have a weak back, then sumo deadlift is going to be a little bit easier because your torso is more upright, right? So you're putting more of the stress on the hips and the quads and not as much stress on the back. Now, if you naturally have weak quads, then a conventional deadlift might be easier. So if you're a dude that always skipped leg day and you have this nice upper body, you have a nice big back, nice chest and arms, but you skipped leg day so you have fucking, you know, stick legs, or you just don't squat, then deadlifting conventional might be a good idea for you, you know, if your goal was to deadlift as much weight as possible. You know, if you're trying to build the legs, then, you know, deadlifting sumo might be the better bet. But hip mobility also plays a major role. Both movements require good hip mobility, particularly the sumo deadlift. And that's part of the reason why after training the sumo deadlift for a while, I switched back to conventional, is just because I didn't have super good hip mobility, and it can take a while to develop good hip mobility. And in that position, I feel like my adductors were not really strong enough to handle what the rest of my body was capable of and what my quads were capable of. And that's an imbalance that I can work through in the future. But I had switched back to conventional because the technique is different. I'm a little bit better at conventional because that's what I've been practicing. Like I said, both are two different exercises because the mechanical requirements are different. And what you need to do is figure out which one works best for you by training both of them for at least 4 to 6 weeks individually. So spend 4 to 6 weeks on sumo deadlift, spend 4 to 6 weeks on your conventional deadlift, and figure out which one, do that to figure out which one works better, feels better, you know, which one can you lift more weight doing, and which one that you like better. Because what it comes down to, given the fact that we are all anatomically different, what it comes down to is what you like and what you're good at, and you should do those things. All right, so let's get into the questions. So Mark asks, my work is doing a Biggest Loser challenge for 2 months. Most of the fat I carry is around my midsection. What is the best way for me to lose fat for this challenge without losing all the muscle I've built over the past couple months? All right, so first, here's a couple of things. Number one is going to be high-intensity interval training. If you haven't been doing that, which chances are you haven't been because you've been trying to build muscle, true high-intensity interval training will definitely help you kick up the metabolism. And if you've been eating at a deficit, then you know maybe spend that first week of the 2 months eating at a calorie surplus, and then go back to a deficit, so you can kind of quickly ramp up your metabolism with some high intensity interval training and some extra calories, and then pull back on the calories and still do the high intensity interval training. And now the reason I say high intensity interval training is because it's a great way to lose weight and to kick up the metabolism and get your body to burn fat, but it's not sustainable long term. So if you're doing something for 2 months, yeah, okay, you can do some high intensity interval training for 2 months. But after that, you know, if your goal is to lose weight, don't keep doing high intensity interval training, because full intensity is very stressful on the body. And if you're working out 4 or 5 times a week and you're doing high intensity interval training every single day and you're like beast mode 100% every day, that's not a good thing for your progress. So consider, don't do it long term, don't do it all the time. The next thing I would say is circuit training. You can definitely take your regular lifting routine and group everything together and do 3 exercises in a circuit and do 5-6 sets of that, and then move on to the next 3 or 4 exercises. That way you're not giving your body rest, a full rest in between movements. You know, you're forcing it to do more work in less time, and you know, you're gonna get a metabolism boosting effect from that. And then lastly, I'd also say spin class. You know, go to those high intensity group classes. If you have trouble pushing yourself by yourself on your own doing high intensity training, you can go to a high intensity training class where it may be easier for you to push yourself, and do that for 2 months. And then what I would say is, you know, and this is coming from the powerlifter side of me, when you're coming up on that, okay, it's crunch time, you know, we're a week out, you know, I've lost X amount of pounds, I want to lose some more weight, you know, start to dehydrate yourself a little bit, because you do carry a lot of water weight. So what you want to do, or what you could do, and you do want to be careful with this, because you can dehydrate yourself to the point where it's fucking bad. But if you watch your sodium intake, for these entire 2 months, because the more salt that you consume, the more water you're going to retain. So if you can slowly start to cut down on your sodium intake, and then the last week, no sodium, like no salt whatsoever, and just be very mindful about how much water you're drinking, you can get yourself down pretty fucking low. Now, it's not going to be maintainable, but you can do it. And you may not feel the greatest. Chances are you won't feel the greatest, but you can get the body weight down lower and kind of just get your body depleted. So watch your sodium intake, watch how much water you're drinking, how much food you're eating. I've used stimulants like caffeine to kind of help flush the body and get it dehydrated. You know, don't go fucking crazy with this, because this can become a slippery slope when you start to dehydrate the body. And it's not a good thing to do long term. You know, if you're just that type of person that's like obsessed with the scale and you want to see a certain weight and you're not doing it for an event, fuck off. This is not for you. Don't fucking do this. But if you are doing it for an event like this, like The Biggest Loser, I have to weigh a certain amount, you know, or as low as I can get at a certain day, and then after that, it doesn't fucking matter what you do. That is something you can possibly do. But if you're just obsessed with seeing a certain number on the scale, this is not for you, and you should just fuck off. Don't do it like this. You need to eat clean and stop eating too little and start training and eat whole natural unprocessed foods. All right, Derek asks, what's the best way to get rid of belly fat besides killing yourself with 1,000 crunches? Wow, it seems like this entire fucking episode has been about nutrition and losing body fat and losing weight. But so the first thing I would do is I would calculate your macronutrients. Calculate your macronutrients. And I wrote a good blog post about this. It's at if you go to executivefitllc.com/woodyfit, that'll be bring you to the podcast page. And if you click on the podcast show notes, you'll be able to browse through all of the blog posts that I've written. A lot of them are show notes, but some of them towards the end is this macronutrient calculator. And I walk you through how to calculate your macronutrients. So that's executivefitllc.com/woodyfit. Click on show notes. Definitely want to calculate your macronutrients, because if you don't know how much of what you should be consuming, then you don't know how much of what you should actually consume, if that makes fucking sense. Consistency with your diet is absolutely essential. If you are not sticking to these are my macros, if you're not sticking to I'm not eating junk food, I'm only focusing on eating whole, natural, unprocessed foods, then it is going to hold you back, because, you know, abs are built in the gym and revealed in the kitchen, because the diet is what gets the body fat down, not the exercise. And then on top of that, dude, Derek, crunches alone are a terrible fucking way for you to tone your abs. And don't just do 1,000 crunches to try to build your abs or tone your abs, because, you know, would you do 1,000 bicep curls if you want to build your biceps? Would you do 1,000 bench presses if you want to build your chest? No, you're going to properly train it with the proper load. So if you want to train your abs to get them to show, train them like you would any other fucking muscle and diet down. And with all that being said, thanks for listening to this episode of Drive with Woody Fit. If you're interested in any of the free guides that we have to offer, head over to executivefitllc.com/guides, where we currently have the basic training program and the ARM 240 Bravo workout, both of which are workouts. The basic training program is a very basic exercise program for the beginner with zero experience. So if you have some experience, that program is not going to be the best for you. That's for somebody who's considering and thinking about getting into working out. So go check that out. Also, the ARM 240 Bravo workout, which is a baller arm workout to help build machine guns for arms instead of those tiny little water pistols that you might have. And if you like the show and you like what we're doing, please leave us a rating and review on your podcast player of choice. And if you could be so kind as to share the show with a friend, family member, or foe. Look at that, all Fs. I'm so good at alliteration tonight. Anyway, thanks for listening to the show, and I'll see you next time on Drive with Woody Fit.